This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Human trafficking, when a person is exploited for sex or forced into labor, is a global problem from Connecticut to Bangkok. How many people does this affect? 46 million, according to the Global Slavery Index. Today, Where We Live, we follow up from an earlier show we aired about human trafficking. Why does the problem persist? Because someone along the supply chain is making money. How much? According to the UN, an estimated $150 billion in profits. We'll hear from advocates for survivors as well as experts on ways the public and private sector can work together to combat trafficking on a global scale. Have you thought about whether what you buy or consume could be helping traffickers? If so, what changes would you support? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. As always, you can comment on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Later in the hour, we'll turn back to Connecticut and its ongoing budget problems, specifically how the state is privatizing services for the developmentally disabled to save millions. But first, I want to welcome back to our studio, Krishna Patel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Krishna is General Counsel and Justice Initiative Director at Grace Farms Foundation. That's in New Canaan, Connecticut. She's also a former federal prosecutor who's worked on trafficking cases. Remind us again, Krishna, when we talk about human trafficking, especially in areas of conflict, what are we talking about?
We're talking about individuals who are essentially being compelled to engage in some type of work, whether in the sex trafficking or in the labor trafficking industry. I think when you distill it to its most essential components, it's compelled work. It is under some kind of fraud, force, or coercion, and it's clearly against their will. It is, in the truest sense, a modern-day form of slavery.
I've seen an estimate of 46 million people that are in this modern-day slavery.
That is correct, and I think if you were to do the math, you're talking about one person, essentially, out of every 162 people on the planet.
What's the percentage of these survivors and victims who are trafficked in the sex trade? Because that's often the one that gets the most attention.
And I think, you know, the percentages are different in different parts of the globe. Certainly, we see a gender component with the sex trade. We see far more women and children. And where here in the U.S., the numbers seem to be much higher in the sex trafficking industry, on a worldwide basis, forced labor tends to be the higher number.
Joining us now is Dr. James Cocaine, head of the United Nations University Office in New York. He's also lead author of the report, Fighting Human Trafficking and Conflict, 10 Ideas for Action by the United Nations Security Council. He joins us from NPR studios in Midtown Manhattan. Welcome to Where We Live.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
So tell us how this conversation ended up at Grace Farms in New Canaan, Connecticut, and the work of this workshop that helped influence this report.
Well, the United Nations has been taking steps to address human trafficking for a long time, for at least the last 15 or 20 years. But in the last year or so, there's been a huge uptick of interest in New York in particular, as there's been growing awareness of the links between human trafficking and modern slavery and conflict, and also the links to larger development questions. Last December, a very brave young Yazidi survivor of Islamic State sex enslavement, Nadia Murad Basitaha, addressed the United Nations Security Council. And as a result, the Security Council asked the UN Secretary General to write a report, which we're expecting to see any time in the next couple of months. The nature of those reports is that they're often quite stale stock-taking exercises. So as a result, several countries came to us at the UN University, a think tank, and asked us to hold a workshop to bring together about 100 people from all over the world, the best and brightest minds, to think about some innovative and creative ways that the Security Council might begin to tackle this problem. And we immediately thought of Krishna and Grace Farms. Krishna's dedication to this issue is very well known, and the work of Grace Farms and the space they have there were uniquely suited to this kind of gathering. So in late June and early July, we brought that 110 people together for this discussion. And the result was the report that you've just mentioned.
Let's talk more about the people who become exploited. Obviously, the world's attention in the last couple of years is on the, 65 million people that have been displaced due to conflicts, including what's happening in Syria with ISIS. You mentioned the Yazidi people that are being victimized, Boko Haram in Nigeria. Can you explain to people, again, how they are, these individuals are being trafficked by terrorist organizations such as these?
Sure. This is a very complex phenomenon, but when you break it down, there are really essentially three different ways that human trafficking connects to conflict. One is that in some cases, groups traffic people into conflict to use them under fraud or coercion, as Krishna said, as part of their own setup. And we see this, for example, with the recruitment of young people from all over the world into conflict zones in the Middle East. A second possibility is that they are trafficking people in the conflict context or out of the conflict context. And that's the point that Krishna made earlier about the involvement of people in essentially forced labor of one kind or another. So we have people who've been displaced by conflict being involved in the conflict zone as lookouts or porters or forced domestic servants or, unfortunately, forced sex slaves in some circumstances. But we also see people being trafficked from the conflict zone into exploitation in a far-off country. So, for example, those 65.3 million people that you mentioned that have been displaced by conflict, as they flee conflict zones, are deeply, deeply vulnerable to that kind of trafficking and exploitation. And then the third kind, unfortunately, is children being recruited into these armed groups.
So walk us through that. Again, much attention on the refugees or the migrants that are trying to get to Europe. When they're getting to that port and they're trying to get on a ship fleeing their homeland from persecution, that is where the traffickers are waiting for them as well?
It may not just be in the port. It's actually all along the chain. So at the workshop, we discussed the situation, for example, in Libya, where you have people fleeing overland from conflicts in West Africa and the Sahel, even from East Africa. They come all the way across to Libya. Libya is at present still being affected by conflict. There are militias that control different parts of the Libyan territory. And the people who are trying to move through that territory to get to the port in order to get onto a boat and then move into Europe are deeply vulnerable to being forced to do all sorts of terrible things in order to barter for that movement, or are simply detained and imprisoned, kidnapped, essentially. Even if they then do get to the port and get on a boat, when they get to the other end, there's growing evidence that, for example, in Italy, mafia groups control the detention centres where those people are received and housed by the state. So all along the chain, these people who've fled and have lost everything that they've worked for in their lives have very, very little bargaining power with the people they're entrusting their lives and their children's lives to if they want to find safety and a better life. And that makes them extremely vulnerable to this kind of exploitation.
Krishna?
So I think, you know, for many of the listeners, to bring it home to our shores, this commonly, we see a very common phenomenon very similar to this happening on our southwest border. People leaving, right, Central and South America for all different reasons, sometimes because of very, very difficult political issues or environmental issues. And most of them come through the Mexico-U.S. border at one of those entry points. And through any time in that process, they're very susceptible to traffickers. And most traffickers are smart enough to actually engage in some type of fraud or deception to get them through into the border. And they don't really realize they're in a terribly terrible trafficking situation until they've already crossed the border. And some, you know, along the way, refugees, either those fleeing from Syria or the immigrants who are trying to come for a better life into the U.S., you know, they can be subject to all sorts of different crimes. But traffickers are definitely aware that they're there and understand how profitable individuals and particularly children can be.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Krishna Patel, General Counsel and Justice Initiative Director at Grace Farms Foundation. That's in New Canaan, Connecticut. Work was done there earlier this summer on a report to
provide more information to the UN Security Council. Also on the joining us from NPR studios in Midtown Manhattan are Dr. James Cocaine, head of the United Nations University Office in New York, lead author of a new report, Fighting Human Trafficking and Conflict, 10 Ideas for Action by the United Nations Security Council. If you have a question or a comment, 860-275-7266. Again, that number, 860-275-7266. I want to turn back to you, James. Can we talk about, you know, what have been the traditional tools that governments, NGOs have been able to use to find traffickers and to prevent this problem from growing, and why have they not been effective?
The traditional tools have been essentially law enforcement tools, criminal justice tools. So criminal investigation, arresting people, following the money, prosecution, that kind of thing. And that's an absolutely essential suite of tools. There's no question that we won't ever really get a handle on this complex problem if we don't figure out ways to better use those tools. But it's inherently challenging to use those tools because these people are hidden. They are being trafficked internationally, and criminal justice tends to stop at the water's edge. And because they're up against essentially an adversary, professional criminal networks that make it their business to avoid detection and certainly disruption by criminal justice actors. So while these tools are definitely necessary, it's also increasingly apparent that they're not sufficient, particularly when we're talking about conflict situations. In those situations, by definition, law enforcement is weak and law and order have broken down. And so what we've been doing in this work with Grace Farms is trying to think about what other kinds of tools might be available beyond law enforcement to help get a handle on this problem and begin to squeeze it from the outside in.
We're going to talk a little bit more about some of those new tools in our coming up after the break. But before we get there, again, I keep mentioning this report, James. Can you talk about some of these ideas for action that you've come up with?
Sure. So we brought together 110 experts from all over the world, from different countries, from law enforcement, from the financial sector, the tech sector, media, of course, civil society and people who've been affected by this themselves. And what they came up with really was four different approaches that the Security Council could take. The first is simply to denounce this activity and hold the people who are engaged in it accountable. There's a very, very strong norm in international law against this kind of thing, human trafficking and modern slavery. But as you yourself said, Lucy, 45.8 million people doesn't sound like a norm being very well enforced globally. So there's a need to reinforce this norm and to make clear that even if armed groups like Islamic State or in Africa, Boko Haram, are claiming that slavery is justified, that's just simply not the case. Slavery is, under international law, never justified anywhere at any time for any reason. So denunciation is the first thing the Security Council could do. The second thing it could do is what we describe as disruption. And that involves monitoring, tracking, looking at where the money from these groups go, and using the tools available to the Council, such as sanctions regimes, to begin to tackle the problem. The third area, and very important, is what's described in the UN as protection. And that means getting out there in the field and finding people who are vulnerable along irregular migration routes, such as Krishna described, and making sure they have the information they need to protect themselves against this kind of exploitation. There's a lot of creative ways we can do that now, for example, through smartphones, finding people who look like, because of their metadata patterns, they may be on the move in an irregular way, they may be in, trying to cross a border, they may be vulnerable to exploitation. We can get that information in front of them, but we haven't really been trying that so far. And finally, the Council should simply keep this on its agenda. There's a lot that the Council could do if it had a framework for action over the longer term.
I'm speaking about human trafficking here on WMPR's Where We Live today. Dr. James Cocaine, head of the United Nations University Office in New York, also Krishna Patel, General Counsel and Justice Initiative Director at Grace Farms Foundation. When we come back from the break, they're going to stick around, and we're going to hear about how the private and tech sectors, among others, can help reduce this global problem. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Human trafficking is an ancient problem, but how has technology aided traffickers, especially in conflict zones, and how can technology be used to crack down on trafficking around the world? Today, Where We Live, we're exploring a recent report by the United Nations think tank and its recommendations to the UN Security Council. In studio with me, Krishna Patel, General Counsel and Justice Initiative Director at Grace Farms Foundation in New Canaan. She's also a former federal prosecutor who worked on trafficking cases. Also joining us from NPR studios in Midtown Manhattan, Dr. James Cocaine, head of the UN University Office in New York, lead author of the report, Fighting Human Trafficking and Conflict, 10 Ideas for Action by the United Nations Security Council. Krishna, I wanted to go back to you and just ask, you know, why should people in Connecticut care about this?
Because modern-day slavery is happening everywhere in the world, and No place is immune. We have slavery statistics, human trafficking statistics in all 50 of our states. And, you know, as James said, something that really came home to me is through the work of James and the other folks at the UN is understanding that slavery, being anti-slavery, is really one of the strongest legal norms in international law. And it is the most brutal and the most horrific of crimes. What we are now holding are two contradictory truths. The idea that we have such a strong legal norm against slavery, and the fact that the possibility is one in every 162 people in our world may be enslaved, including here in the United States, including here in Connecticut. And so every single citizen, I think, has a moral obligation to not only be aware, but to engage in whatever capacity he or she can to continue to support a norm against slavery.
We were talking before the show, a recent investigation by the Associated Press to give us an idea of how trafficking is happening all around us, even in this country. Hundreds of undocumented men from Southeast Asia are employed in Hawaii due to a federal loophole that allows them to work but exempts them from most basic labor protections. They can earn as little as 70 cents an hour. And under this law, the U.S. citizens make up 75% of these fishing crews on these commercial fishing vessels. But the other quarter percent, because of legislation and passed and promoted by the late Hawaii Senator Daniel Inouye, he pushed for a loophole to support the biggest industry in Hawaii. So it exempts commercial fishing boat owners from federal rules enforced almost everywhere else. So in this situation, you have these undocumented men that get paid little for the work that they're doing, and they can't even leave the boats.
Correct. And, you know, besides just inhuman labor conditions, and I think, you know, Martha Mendoza's work has gone so far, all of the work by the Associated Press on the Thai fishing industry, the Indonesian fishermen, and it's really brought it home to our own shores here in the U.S. And, you know, the fish that you are seeing showing up in your stores, I think the article talks about, you know, places like Walmart, places like Costco.
Whole Foods.
And, you know, the fish that you are buying could have been because of, you know, someone who was enslaved. And so I think we have such an incredible obligation as citizens to really start looking and thinking about the purchases that we're making and our purchasing power and our own ability. We sometimes feel these problems are so big, so complex, so overwhelming. But this is a place where you can ask questions. You can become informed enough that your own purchasing power as a consumer can make such an extraordinary difference in the lives of people. And, you know, it reinforces that this is not – while this is happening in Indonesia and in India and in Thailand, that, you know, what we are doing here is a cause of it.
Have you thought about whether what you buy or consume could be helping traffickers? If so, what changes would you support? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. James Cocaine, I wanted to go back to you. Earlier you mentioned the UN specifically is looking at this problem late last year after hearing from a Yazidi woman. And I'm curious if, you know, obviously the UN's paying attention, but what about just regular consumers? Do you see a shift happening?
I do think we see a shift happening, but we need governments and business to work together to make this easier for consumers. If you go into a store, let's take Whole Foods because you mentioned it, Lucy, you know, there is a very simple rating system when you get to that meat fridge about just how sustainable the meat was in the way it was produced. But then if you go to another part of the store and try to identify which of those products have been produced with, say, child labor, it's extremely opaque. It's very, very tough for a consumer to know which products, goods and services they're consuming may be at risk of generating, of unwittingly supporting human trafficking in conflict or otherwise. So there's clearly a need for us to work together, for business to take leadership, but to get the support they need from regulators to make this something that's worth their while to do. Otherwise, it's going to be extremely hard for consumers to exercise that kind of leverage. And the other thing I would say here is that we have to make sure that we're not simply naming and shaming. Naming and shaming is very important, but if the knee-jerk response when human trafficking is found in a supply chain is simply to drop that producer, it can have all sorts of unintended negative consequences for the people who are actually working for that company in the first place. So we need a multi-stakeholder approach that develops a sophisticated response to ensure that those victims are actually not left worse off than they might otherwise be.
I wanted to bring into the conversation now Duncan Jepson, founder and director of the Asia-based nonprofit organization Liberty Asia. Duncan, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi. Nice to meet you. Thanks very much for having me on.
So tell us about your nonprofit. When we talk about this global problem, obviously data matters. So how is Liberty Asia helping collect that data and sharing it with the appropriate people?
We try to look at the problem from, could we have a systemic impact? And you know, my background is in part of it certainly within running compliance and legal teams and financial services companies across Asia Pacific. And one of the things that always I remember back in 2004, we get a letter from the U.S. State Department listing names, various variants of the names of Bin Laden, and we're obviously required to check whether we had accounts, and like everybody else, and we did so. But what amazed me is that we were never asked to check in anybody else by anybody, and that's not the responsibility of certain entities to produce names, but civil society could produce some names for banks and financial services to check and so forth. So it never really happened, and there seemed to be just a need to use information, intelligence and data. I would say more wisely, but where it simply hadn't been used before, and what we had started to do was look to see where that could be gathered, where it was available, and how it needed to be analyzed in order to be made available to others that could make use of it and essentially make better business decisions. Whether it was who to do business with or just how to do business, and so. That's, I suppose, the fundamentals of what a strong part of Liberty Asia is about, is gathering information and then, providing it to people who can use it to make better decisions in favor of better business, better employment. And part of that, obviously, is in both the prevention of and the disruption of slavery, exploitation, and human trafficking.
Have you been doing this for some time, or is this relatively new?
So we've been doing it for about 3 years now in this form. We have a sort of technology industry sort of fast fail approach, which is, keep trying things, talking to people, learning from them, seeing where, how to gather information, how to store it, how to better analyze it, and then how to communicate it along. And we've had some good successes recently, and then we've also had some fails where we thought, well, that isn't going to work. That might be because of a risk of a legal issue, or it might be because the recipient doesn't necessarily want the information. So it's been about 3 years of that. And then I think that the people that we have been doing this kind of work for, like myself, for 10, 15 years.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about human trafficking. I want to turn back to Krishna Patel. You were a former federal prosecutor, so something that Duncan was mentioning, you know, there's been data sharing, especially after 9/11, between law enforcement, financial regulators, private sector, in terms of where the terrorists are, how they're financing, what they're doing, but not necessarily the fact that, you know, this is coming from trafficking of people. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think, you know, certainly after 9/11, we being the U.S. federal government, put a tremendous amount of time, resources, and effort not only to collaborate better within our internal agencies, whether it be our intelligence and our domestic law enforcement agencies, but spent an enormous effort on collecting, reviewing, and analyzing data to counter terrorists around the world in the most classic sense. And, you know, I will tell you, terrorism, because your job is to prevent a crime, people don't get to hear when you're successful. They only get to hear when you're unsuccessful. And I really do believe this is where the U.S. government has done it quite well. We, you know, while we have a long way to go, we have done amazing work in in my prior work, I had seen just tremendous work done. And data collection storage was a very, very important part of it. There are important conversations happening, for example, the civil society, the civil rights private sector side of it and data, and those continue to need to happen. But the data was incredibly effective to counterterrorism. And I think we're seeing some of that play out where our friends in Europe have perhaps not focused as much on data and its capabilities. And what has really, truly been inspiring for me on that front is the artificial intelligence component of data. However, having said that, as much as trafficking is so tied into terrorism in certain aspects, certainly the work that James and the UNU has focused in on, we have not done that same type of work with human trafficking. And we really need to, because for all of the reasons that terrorism is so hard, it is international, it's cross-jurisdictional, it is very clandestine, it's very decentralized. That's trafficking as well. They're very hard cases to prosecute in the traditional sense. And so, you know, the data, I think, is an exceptionally critically important point to disrupt and counter anti-trafficking in the world.
So let's talk specifically about one example. You know, having spoken to you in the past, the plight of the Yazidi people and what ISIS is doing to the women and children. Can you talk to our listeners about that and how governments could go after how ISIS is financing their organization through trafficking?
So, you know, ISIS and ISIL, you know, and their various names, specifically with the Yazidis, I think shows you possibly all of the worst horrors of trafficking. ISIL has decided that slavery is okay. They are actively and intentionally and willfully abducting and enslaving women, girls, and men, the girls and women into rape camps. And the stories are beyond horrifying. They are inhuman. And there's two aspects of it. It is a psychological weapon of war, destruction of the enemy. But they are also now, because of the ransoms, being able to finance their operations through trafficking, just purely alone. They're buying and selling women. And so you're seeing both a financing component as well as a psychological weapon of war component. And when you're looking at ISIS, how it may be able to fund itself in other ways, how it's able to get arms and get money, I think that it's very critical at some point either the illicit money has to go into a legitimate financial system or money from a legitimate financial system has to go to buy illicit products. And those are two points where the world and the financial industry and the banking industry and the collaboration between the private and the public become so critical to create disruptive mechanisms. So in the same way, for example, as Duncan just pointed out, you know, when the U.S. government wanted information on Osama bin Laden, there was nothing, everything was on the table, including asking every single financial institution to look at every version of every name and family member and associate through the banking system and any corporate entity. We can do the same thing with traffickers.
I'll turn back to Duncan Jepson again, his nonprofit Liberty Asia. Tell me again about some of that work that you know you're helping with collect and how it's getting shared, you know, to combat? Can it combat something as big as ISIS?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the question is where does the actual exploitation occur, and where does the money that comes from that exploitation arise? And then, of course, it may get channeled back to a variety of destinations, and ISIL being one of them, Boko Haram and so forth. And I think the question is, where are the opportunities to make money from exploitation, and where can you make the most money? And, you know, as Christian was saying, that obviously the place where it occurs most is where you create something that you can lock in your profits into a legitimate market. Obviously hard to lock in a profit in an unlawful criminal market because you don't know what's going to occur. But you can do that with the fishing industry. You can do that with mining extraction and so forth. You, at some point, you're going to get a lawful deal, and that obviously at that point is money laundering. And that's when it starts to get interesting, because there's that space allows you to identify the activities on the ground, people speaking to victims, understanding what has happened to the victims. And there is information, you know, the victims have that, you know, anonymously, obviously, can be used then to understand, okay, if this is a geography, a particular place, as James was saying earlier, where rule of law has broken down, where corruption is high, the geography is controllable, money can be accessed, both can be moved out and moved in. You know, that once you have that environment, then you have an opportunity to do all sorts of things, and one of those things is going to be to exploit other people for gain. And you know, then it becomes an issue for those who work in various areas to think, well, okay, where's that money going? And is it going to terrorists? Is it just going to you know, transnational organized crime? Is it going back into the hands of government agencies and politicians? And so there's questions to be asked at all those points. And that's where we need much more data and much more information. And, you know, there are people that do have it. It's that they don't necessarily realize they have it, or realize that it's useful to share it.
I'll turn back to Dr. James Cocaine again, head of the UN University Office in New York, lead author of this report, Fighting Human Trafficking in Conflict, 10 Ideas for Action by the United Nations Security Council. With this new report, how does it build on the work that Liberty Asia is doing, James?
Well, the key question here for the Security Council is business as usual good enough, or do they need to give a nudge, a big signal to states and to the private sector that they want to see a paradigm shift, that they want to see the kind of shoulder being put to the wheel that Krishna described happening after 9/11 around terrorism in this country and to some extent abroad. If we got that signal from the Security Council in one form or another, it would have a trickle-down effect through the way that states look at the problem and deal with it, through the way that the UN's own sanctions committees deal with it, and that sends signals to the private sector to put resources and thought and time and money into finding solutions here. And that's when you're going to start to see the solutions unlocked. And this requires the Security Council to move outside of its comfort zone. For example, the Security Council doesn't really talk much to the tech industry. But we know now that, for example, Islamic State is using apps like WhatsApp, Threema, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, to recruit and traffic women and children, and then to auction them off. Those companies have a responsibility to respect human rights. They have data available, but they're not getting the signals from their own regulators or from the international community that they need to share that data in a safe, privacy-respecting way, but a way that will allow people like Duncan to take the data and turn it into a meaningful outcome.
And so you have this report. What is next?
Well, next, as you know, the UN is a place where we do a lot of talking. We need a place like that in the world. As Winston Churchill said, better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. It's a place we can resolve differences. So there'll be a lot of discussion of this report, and there'll also be a separate report from the Secretary General on what can be done in this area. We hope that our report will inform that Secretary General's report. And then we can anticipate the Security Council sitting down in December and deciding how to move forward from here.
You mentioned a survivor of trafficking, Nadia Murad Bassi Taha. Next Friday, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime and the permanent mission of the U.S. to the UN are going to have a ceremony for the appointment of a goodwill ambassador for the dignity of survivors of human trafficking. We have a sound clip from her presentation to the UN last year. Let's hear that.
Before the 3rd of August 2014, I was living with my family in Kuju village, with my mother, my brothers and sisters, in our pretty little quiet village. But then the Islamic State attacked our region. We found ourselves faced with a true genocide. A large number of these forces of evil had come from different states with weapons and equipment and uniforms. Their aim was to eliminate all Yazidis under the pretext that, according to them, we were infidels. The Islamic State did not just come to kill our women and girls, but they took us as war booty, as merchandise to be exchanged. These crimes were not committed in an arbitrary fashion. It was an organized, planned policy. The Islamic State came with one sole aim: to destroy the Yazidi identity through force, rape, the recruitment of children, and the destruction of all of our temples.
That's Nadia speaking through an interpreter. I'll turn back to you, Krishna Patel. When you hear that kind of testimony about what is happening, you know, is this the kind of testimony that will get people into action? Obviously, the UN is more interested, but what more can be done?
I think everybody needs to hear her story, and I think everybody needs to listen to stories like hers. There's 5,000 to 6,000 Yazidi women and girls currently enslaved in rape camps. It is an all-out misogynistic war on women and girls. It is a genocide. It is why the UN had been created in the first place, to ensure the peace and security against the genocide, against the Holocaust of an entire group of people. And I think all of us need to wake up to it, and all of us need to learn about it, and all of us need to do something about it.
Speaking of which, we heard from a listener, Billy from Middletown. He wanted to know, you know, how he and others could help. Are there volunteer organizations where he could get involved?
There are. James actually had invited the leading organization from northern Iraq. And Yazda and others are very involved in supporting the Yazidi women and girls. I know that it's not intentional on any of our parts, but we're talking about the children of Boko Haram. We're talking about the Lord's Resistance Army, you know, individuals in Somalia and Sudan who are undergoing this. And so there's various groups in each of those regions. I think from actively supporting them through whether it's volunteer efforts or donations, I think one of the most important things we need to do as a society in this country is be proud of the fact that we live in a democracy. And the State Department is a permanent member. The United States is a permanent member on the Security Council. It's to advocate to the White House and the State Department to say that this is something that we need to start taking very seriously. Trafficking as a policy, or anti-trafficking, even though it's happening in all 50 states, even in this presidential election, is not something that we are seeing consistently as a top policy issue. And it needs to be.
Thank you, Krishna Patel, General Counsel and Justice Initiative Director at Grace Farms Foundation in New Canaan. Also, Dr. James Cocaine, he joined us from NPR Studios in Midtown Manhattan, head of the UN University Office in New York. Thank you for your time. And Duncan Jepson, founder and director of the Asia-based nonprofit organization Liberty Asia. Continue this conversation on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. And then when we return, we're going to talk more about the budget situation here in Connecticut. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Thursday, illicit use of prescription drugs has almost tripled among high school students in southeastern Connecticut. That's according to the Southeastern Regional Action Council. On the next Where We Live, we'll explore what schools and communities are doing to combat drug abuse among youth in our state. We'll speak with educators, parents, municipal leaders, and mental health professionals. And we want to hear from you, too. That's Thursday. Today, we're shifting back to Connecticut right now and to our state's budget problems. One way Connecticut is saving money is to privatize group homes for people with developmental disabilities. Parents of these adult children are protesting the move. One of them joins us now in studio. Lindsay Matthews is a parent and legal guardian of an adult with developmental disabilities. Lindsay, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much, Lucy. It's great to be here.
Tell us about your son.
Oh, my son. His name is George. He's 51 years old. He can't talk. He can't make decisions about what he wants to eat. He can't button a shirt. He can't put on his shoes. He can't drive. But he can love and express himself. You know, even if you're able to make a sound, that's not speech. And so for him, not being able to talk means that he doesn't have the power of the word to direct his life, to say what he wants, to say what his life will be.
So he's 51. You've needed help throughout the years as you've raised him. Where is he living now?
He's a resident at Brook Street Group Home in Hamden. There are four other housemates. He's been there for quite some time, almost 20 years. And this is his home, away from home, of course. And it's my home because he's there and because the people who take such good care of him are my family.
So I'm reading he has cerebral palsy and has profound intellectual impairments. If you didn't have this group home to help your son, I mean, what would be the alternative?
Well, you know, the way I look at it is to have George receive the services of DDS, it's not voluntary. I've had people say to me, well, if you don't like the services or what's happening in DDS, then just take him out. DDS services are voluntary to people who are in the 1% because they can afford any kinds of services that their handicapped or disadvantaged child can needs. But for the rest of us, we need DDS as a core service for the state of Connecticut. To me, DDS, the Department of Developmental Services, is part of the commons in the same way that Social Security is part of the commons, that unemployment is part of the commons, that our public roads are part of the commons. They're there for everyone who need them. And right now, we have some serious problems in Connecticut making sure that that happens.
I wanted to bring into the conversation on the phone with us Michelle Sorensen. She works at the group home where George is, Brook Street Group Home in Hamden. Michelle, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
So tell us about your relationship with George and the other adults that you're helping there.
I love my job. It's not a job. They are, I actually look forward to going there. I love their smiles. I enjoy what I do. We're just very close. We're very close-knit. As Lindsay said, we're a family. We know the little quirks that everybody has. We like to tease each other. But when it comes down to it, Brook Street is a group home with 24 hours, 7 days a week medical care. The individuals that I serve are nonverbal. Some are wheelchair or bed-bound. And it's a total care facility. And they depend on us, the staff, for all their needs. Things that we take for granted, like Lindsay had said, you know, making breakfast, lunch, dinner. You know, if they're sick, Lindsay had said making a noise. Well, different individuals, the way they look, a twitch in their eye, a cough or clearing of the throat, that lets us know that there's something wrong with them. That lets me know that there's an individual who's in crisis and that needs medical attention right away.
You've worked at Brook Street Group Home for how long?
6 years. I've been with the state of Connecticut for just over 18 years with the Department of Disability Services.
Okay, so you are an employee of the state. So with this privatization, what does that mean for your job?
That I'll eventually lose my job. And when I lose it, then I'll just be on the unemployment line getting, you know, state funding as far as, you know, Medicare, or not Medicare, excuse me, as far as medical needs, maybe the Husky situation, because there's, you know, there's nothing more that that is out there for me once I lose my job. But it really isn't about me losing my job. If I may, it's about what's going to happen to the individuals that I serve. That's what's more bothersome to me, to be honest with you. The continuity of care is on my mind. How are they going to know these individuals? The private group homes, that private sector has 100% turnaround rate. So how is the continuity of care going to be established Where is the trust that's going to be formed? Where is the love? Where is that family aspect that Brook Street has been known for? That's what's bothersome to me when we talk about privatization of our group home or any of the other group homes that they're trying, that the governor thinks we should close.
Lindsay Matthews, again, is in studio with us. She's a parent and legal guardian of an adult with developmental disabilities named George. You filed a lawsuit against the state. Tell us about that, Lindsay.
Yes. I think you asked me earlier what made me do it. And I have to say in one word, anger. And there's probably a more sophisticated word, which is righteous indignation. And the lawsuit was filed last week, and there are two main issues. One is to stop the privatized care for my son George, which I have objected to. And the second part is my right to privacy under HIPAA law that protects George's medical records from being shared with shoppers who would like to have a contract with Brook Street Group Home. I just wanted to get back to that and say that Brook Street was very attractive to what I call shoppers, nonprofit organizations, which, by the way, are not totally nonprofit. They are also ours in the sense that our tax dollars go to fund them. So one of the most egregious things that I can think of right now is the lack of respect for my wishes and that George not be in a private situation. But on a grander scale, this fight is about all Connecticut parents and guardians of handicapped adults and children who need services. It's not just about George. It's not about me. It's going to set the tone for what happens here on out in Connecticut in regard to privatization and in other states as well.
I wanted to read to you a statement from the governor's office, spokesman Chris McClure. He wrote, 90% of those living in community service arrangements are receiving services and facilities operated by nonprofits and community providers. The privatization plan, this step, will save taxpayer dollars without affecting service levels. What's your reaction to that, Lindsay?
My reaction to that is my son has a certain amount of dollars coming into the group home. And because he's handicapped, he's not at a resort or a Club Med. He gets this money as a benefit to mitigate the problems that he's facing as a handicapped individual. And to say that that this is, you know, a move that's similar or equal to what he's receiving now is ludicrous. The money that he's being, quote, sold for to the private enterprises, nonprofits, is being almost halved. And you can hear them saying, you know, DDS saying that this is going to cost a lot less. Well, maybe, because our idea is to keep the workers who are in the group homes now, all 30 of them, and ours included, keep them there. Let them work and work for the private company. Let them have their union contract enforced. And if there are some openings, then let them come from the nonprofits. That's the way we see is that's the best solution for us right now. And that's, to me, the most cost-saving road to go on.
Lindsay, I assume that you've been a resident of Connecticut for some time. You know about the budget problems. It's only going to worsen in the out years. I mean, are Connecticut's hands tied in terms of having to look at steps like privatization to provide services to people like your son, George, but to also, you know, they've got to figure out a way to get out of the red. What do you say to that? We have about a minute.
It's endless war. That's the problem. That's the elephant in the room. Endless wars are killing us. They're sapping us of all of our resources. So that's the big picture. Is every state dealing with these problems? Absolutely. Is it a trend? Well, yes, it's a trend. Does it have to continue? No, absolutely not. Another component of the endless war problem that's draining us is the fact in Connecticut that the wealthy, the 1%, are not paying their fair share of taxes. And I really get it when the legislators say, we don't have the revenue. And we don't. But we have to get it.
That's Lindsay Matthews, a parent and legal guardian of George, an adult with developmental disabilities. Thank you, Lindsay, for just telling us a part of your story.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
Also, Michelle Sorensen, who works at that group home where George has been cared for, Brook Street Group Home in Hamden, slated for privatization later this month. We'll continue the story as the weeks and months continue, but I appreciate your time, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
This is Where We Live.